and welcome to episode 217 of the Book Cougars, two middle-aged women on the hunt for a good read. I'm Emily.
And I'm Chris.
We are going to talk about our Q3 read-along of Envy by Sandra Brown this episode.
Yes, we had a fantastic discussion with some listeners on Zoom over the weekend. Really great conversation. We also wanted to let you know that our Q4 title in our year of reading romance will be announced on the next episode.
Right. So not this one. We promise it's coming. Should we tease? We also know what our theme is going to be for 2025.
Wow, Emily.
I'm teasing. We really do.
We do. I mean, we don't know what our Q4 book is yet, but we know about next year. So go figure. Also in this episode at the end, we hope you enjoy our interview with author James Benn, author of the Billy Boyle World War II mystery series. He joined us to talk about his latest, The Phantom Patrol.
Yeah, number 19 in the series. So, Chris, what are you currently reading?
Well, I'm currently reading three books on three different formats. I'm reading A Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens in paperback. This is a buddy read I'm doing with our friend Sigrid. I am reading a book that's not coming out until February 2025, but when the advanced reader copy came through, I just had to start it immediately. It is Jane Austen's Bookshelf, a rare book collector's quest to find the women writers who shaped a legend. This is by Rebecca Romney. It's coming out February 18th from Simon & Schuster, and I am loving it. You know, I love Jane Austen. I love the work of recovering women writers from the past who've been forgotten. This is the first time I'm reading something like that from a non-academic perspective.
Right, because Rebecca Romney is a rare book collector. Mm-hmm. We had her on as a prior guest. We'll put her episode in the show notes.
Yes, so it's a really wonderful book so far. I'm super excited to be reading it. And then I'm also reading That Librarian, The Fight Against Book Banning in America by Amanda Jones. This is a book that just came out last month, and I'm listening to it on audio via Libro. And I really am enjoying it so much. I mean, it's hard content. She's a librarian who was targeted and smeared by an organization that is trying to ban books and freedom to read. So she really details how that went down and how heartbreaking and shocking it was, not only to see people who she didn't know talking about her and saying horrific things about her that were complete lies on social media, but then people she knew her entire life in the community jumping on the bandwagon.
Yeah, I read an interview, I think it was in Book Page, the magazine you get at the library, the monthly magazine, and that was really heartrending. She was talking about, I'm pretty sure it's a pretty small town that she lives in, and born and raised, maybe, and these people that she's known forever, and how it was impacting her life.
Yeah, people who loved her teaching so much and how she helped their child. And social media can just be such a cruel, wicked place. And some people tend to want to believe whatever they see and read or just want attention. It's just pretty sad. I just started it. I'm only like 10% in, and I look forward to hearing about how she fought back. What about you?
I'm reading The Mighty Red by Louise Erdrich. I think our BookTube, I was like, is it Erdrich or Erdrich? It's Erdrich, like the hard K, even though it's spelled with a CH. And I also learned that her name means rich earth.
Oh, wow.
Isn't that lovely? Cool. Yeah. Thank you to Harper for the advanced reader copy. This book comes out on October 1st, so you can pre-order it now. And I, too, am just a little bit into this. It has very short chapters, which I'm really enjoying from different character point of views. And it takes place in Argus, North Dakota. Louise Erdrich is from that area, so is very good at describing the landscape and the people there. And it starts with the character Crystal. I'm not sure how to pronounce her last name. Crystal Frischetti, I think is her name. And she's a trucker, and she's delivering sugar beets back and forth from the farm to this warehouse. And she's caring for her daughter, whose name is Kismet, who's in high school, and there seems to be a little love triangle. Kismet is interested in the high school quarterback and also the nerdy homeschooled kid that she's been friends with forever. So that's about as far as I've gotten. The Mighty Red refers to the Red River, which borders Minnesota and North Dakota.
Yeah, Marcy Rendon had right. a Red River in her mystery novel, the one we read, was that last year or 2 years ago?
Yes. Yeah. That's right. And I think the book is going to have conversation about, it's a novel, but a conversation about people interacting with our Earth and climate change and things like that. But I haven't really gotten to that part. So again, that's called The Mighty Red by Louise Erdrich, out on 10/1.
And what have you just read? Should we dive into our envy conversation?
Sure. We both just read that.
Yes, we did.
So recap for people, you know, we are reading romance this year in our quarterly read-alongs. And so far, we've chosen trailblazer authors who've been at the game of romance writing for quite some time. All three of them are still at the game. Sandra Brown just had a book come out last year and has another one coming out in like 2 months or something. Very prolific. And this novel, Envy, is in the mystery, suspense, thriller subgenre of romance.
Yes. And it came out in 2001. And the action is set in the 1980s and then presumably 90s. And it is a real page-turner.
It is. Our listener, Colleen, who couldn't unfortunately be at our Zoom conversation, sent an email saying she felt like it was like a movie. The action was very movie-like. And I agree. It was a real page-turner in that way.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. And it took me back in time. I think, as I mentioned last episode, it has all of the isms and phobias and whatnots, a lot of sexism. And quite shocking, probably, for people who maybe weren't adults in the 80s or 90s to see like how women were treated and spoken to and dismissed.
Especially in corporate America, because the main protagonist is in the publishing industry and she's, you know, got a highbrow job in the publishing industry.
Right. Yeah. So she's the daughter of a guy who started a publishing company, very prominent publishing company. He's pretty elderly and is retired, and she is going to be taking over the press along with her husband, who is a bit sketch.
Very sketch, it turns out. His name is Noah.
Noah Reed.
Yes.
Which totally confused me, as I mentioned. That is such a biblical name. You think about Moses and the reeds and then Noah's Ark and Noah Reed. I don't know if she's trying to throw us off the scent a little bit with that kind of name. But yeah, there will be potential spoilers in our brief conversation of Envy here, since it is a read-along book. So, but we won't completely ruin things for people.
But to give you an example of how sketchy he is, he throws an anniversary party for Maris that's at an apartment, a newly set up apartment that she didn't even know existed, because he had written a book, theoretically written a book that she loved, one and only book that he ever wrote. And so he teases that he's taken on this apartment because he's going to try to get back to writing. And as soon as the party's over, he walks down the street to his lover's apartment right, to tell her all about the party.
It's all a ruse. It's all, he has this whole writing setup. He's a slimy, slimy man.
Yeah.
Some of the sexist stuff, at one point, she even has to say, when it comes to business, I'm not a daughter or a wife. I'm an officer of this corporation. Because there are situations where both her father and her husband are not looping her in on things. I mean, you know why the husband isn't, because he is lying left and right. And the father, you find out, he's working things from a different angle to try and find out what's really going on, because he knows Maris, his daughter, is not very happy.
Right.
Yeah.
In her marriage.
And so Maris goes off. There's this mysterious prologue that is delivered to her with no name of the author on it other than initials. And she's captivated by this prologue and tracks things down to find out that he's living on an island off Georgia.
Right. And just to show the difference between how you would track someone down in this day and age, if the book took place in this day and age, it'd be pretty easy with the Google. But she calls the local sheriff to look for someone with these initials and finds him.
Yeah. Yeah. So things take off. And so it's a story within a story, because this mysterious writer in Georgia is writing this novel that is the story about characters in the story that you're reading in the novel. And so it's really kind of fun and twisty in that way. And you try to figure out who's who and who did what.
Yeah. I mean, that part was quite brilliant, I think. I think she's a very good writer.
Yeah. And I did not see some of the things coming. I was totally. Just like, oh, this is awesome. And I don't really consciously try to figure out what's going on in a mystery. I mean, sometimes I do. Sometimes I'm like, oh my God, so-and-so did it. It really gets me. In this kind of book, it wasn't. It was just a page turner. I guess maybe that's more the definition of a thriller. You're just turning the pages, thriller suspense, as opposed to like mystery, where like you're trying to figure out.
Well, or like mystery and like, okay, someone's found dead. Now let's figure it out. It wasn't that kind of a mystery at all.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, but so good. I mean, so good and so bad in terms of how women and different minority groups were treated. There's a lot of homophobia. There's anti-Semitism. Racism is not really there because there are no people of color mentioned as characters. The only person who is mentioned who is a enslaved person who carved this beautiful fireplace mantle like 200 years ago.
Right.
Which is a huge absence when you're writing about New York City and Georgia.
Mm-hmm. Well, as our listener Robin G said during the Zoom, she said, there's something in this book to offend everyone.
Yes.
I thought that was really well said.
Yeah, definitely. And not everybody enjoyed this novel. A lot of the people who were able to make the Zoom conversation, some of us loved it. Some people really didn't like it at all.
Yeah, I think for some people, it was really hard to get past the misogyny and some of the things that we just don't expect to be reading about when we open a novel that is written either in current day or maybe written now. Even if it's something that's historical, there's just different languaging that we use when we're describing things or using dialogue, right?
Yeah. And I think that's a thing. I think historic writers and even writers today sometimes get dinged for putting things in characters' mouths and then they're treated as if they're saying it when it's just like, no, it's the character and they're trying to show something about a particular character.
Right. Yeah.
But, you know, it's relentless in this book.
Yeah.
It is. If you want to read for enjoyment, that could be a challenge.
Yeah. I think that the people who seemingly enjoyed it took it for what it was. I think one of the other things Robin said is it felt like a soap opera, like an 80s or 90s soap opera, and it made her think of Dallas and J.R. Ewing and stuff like that, right? And I totally agree.
Yeah.
But I think that the way that she intertwined, because there are chapters of this novel that the character Parker is writing, like the prologue is the very beginning of the book. So you step into the book within the book right at the very beginning.
Yeah.
And I think the way that she was able to weave all of that in was pretty well done. And I really enjoyed that part. And it also kept me guessing till the very end. Some people said they figured it out straight away. I figured out parts of it, but there were things at the very end that I was like, what? So
yeah.
I really enjoyed it. I just really did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we kind of noticed too, a little bit of like a generational split in some ways that younger readers had more problems with it versus some of the older readers who were like, yeah, I loved it. You could see how things have changed. So that was an interesting thing too. And we also want to say we chose this novel, as Emily said earlier, because it was a trailblazer by a trailblazer. And also Sandra Brown is most proud of this novel. She was asked about that on the Fated Mates podcast, which novel would she choose as one that she's going to go down in romance history for. And she's very proud of Envy, and she totally should be. I think it's such a really well-written story. And then when we were kind of looking around on reader reactions, a lot of readers were saying, you know, you get those questions like on Reddit, like, where do I start with this writer? A lot of people would say Envy was their favorite Sandra Brown and a good one to start with.
Yeah. And it's also interesting because she maybe sticks it to the publishing industry a little bit with it. So it makes you wonder if it was also her chance, because she did start out in more classic romance writing, if this novel was her chance to say, I want to take a left turn, I want to write in a different genre, and I'm going to call the publishing industry to task a little bit when I do it. I've no idea. I've never heard her say that in an interview.
Right. But like, it is missing some of the more yucky tropes that were in earlier romance novels, although there are hints of it still.
Yeah.
But, you know, this character, Maris, is a businesswoman, a very successful businesswoman, although, as some people have said, she's not shown working a whole lot. But it's also hard to show the work of creative people. She is working with this new author that she wants to help develop. She's reading his pages. They're talking about his pages, where the novel's going. And that's hard to depict. As Cal Newport would say, you're not dealing with widgets that people can actually see piling up.
Maybe to end this conversation, Chris, and what you're talking about, there are little interviews with Sandra Brown out and about. All of the three women that we have chosen so far as trailblazers and authors we read for our read-alongs don't really do many interviews because they're all busy writing a lot. They're all very prolific. And one of the little snippets of an interview I saw with Sandra Brown where she was being asked questions, and I can't remember the question they asked, but it was something about being a writer. And she said the thing that bothers her the most is when people kind of say things about writers as if they're not working hard. And she said, you know, I work so hard. And my job is to make up stories that are interesting. So I'm in my head a lot. And that is my version of work. Mm-hmm. And I really appreciated that. And reading this novel, I felt like she is a really good writer. So she is working hard at her craft. And this book, I think, was the 14th book. And she's written over 70.
Yeah.
Busy, busy person.
And 50 of which have been New York Times bestsellers. Yeah. You know, I had an English teacher in one of my very early English classes who had us write a short story. And it had to be something like 12 pages. And this was an English class where we were reading literature. And I think it was brilliant of this teacher to have us do that. Because when you first start critiquing literature, you can be really kind of harsh, especially as you start getting more books under your belt and reading more theory. And by having us try to write a short story, you see how friggin' hard it is to even have a little piece of dialogue sound like it's not coming from Woody Woodpecker, you know?
Yeah.
So I often think about that. I don't even remember the guy's name, but I thought that was a really good exercise.
Yeah.
And then we had to read them in front of the class. Okay, talk about another layer of horror. But this one guy wrote a brilliant short story about a college student who was not going to class, but he was watching Jeopardy all the time. And I still remember that story. Anyway, that's a bit of a diversion. But yeah, writing is hard work. Yeah. And being that kind of editor, working with writers,
yeah,
it's hard work. It's a lot of brain power.
And that's why I'm glad we're reading the romance genre this year and focusing on it, because I think in general, the genre also gets...
Yeah, they get dismissed as fluff.
Yes, dismissed.
As if anyone can do it.
Yeah. So I'm glad we've chosen Trailblazers. Our next book... We are still working on what we're going to choose for Q4, but we think we are going to go more contemporary and somebody who's maybe even a debut novelist.
Yes.
More to come on that on episode 218. Well, I read another book that went down in one big gulp. It's called The Most by Jessica Anthony. And days after I read this, it was longlisted for the National Book Award, which was pretty cool.
Very.
And this, I read it in one sitting. It's 133 pages, so I don't know if it would be considered a novella. Oh my God, this book was so good. And this is one of those, I closed it and I was like, I really want to talk to somebody about it. It takes place over the course of 8 hours. On November 3rd, 1957, which happens to coincide and be the day that the second Sputnik was launched with the dog in it, which I guess was very controversial. I didn't know that until I was reading this novel and had to Google all of that because the dog didn't live. And so that was very cruel. That's a sidebar, but that is part of this novel. And it's about Virgil and Kathleen Beckett, who are married and move from Pawtucket, Rhode Island to Newark, Delaware. And they move into an apartment in a complex with their two young boys. And Kathleen wakes up on church Sunday and announces to her husband that she doesn't feel up to going to church. So he takes the boys off to church. It's a very hot day, and she climbs into the apartment complex kidney-shaped swimming pool and spends the next 8 hours there. It is so well written and such an inventive way to tell a story, I feel like, because she, even though this woman is sitting in a swimming pool and it takes place over the course of 8 hours, she takes on the ideas of marriage and fidelity and motherhood. I mean, going back to what it's like to be an accomplished high school and college athlete and then become a mother. I just loved it. And she did all of it in 133 pages. Wow. She is also the author of a book called Enter the Aardvark, which I remember people talking about because it was a very inventive writing style. I don't remember if she told it completely from two different perspectives, but it was something about politics. So if people recognize her name, Jessica Anthony, it might be because of that novel as well. Again, this is called The Most by Jessica Anthony. For the first time in years, I've read one of the books that's longlisted for the National Book Award. And actually, James by Percival Everett is too. So I've read two. Yeah. So that's cool. It's a very compelling list, the long list this year.
Indeed. So, yes. Yeah.
And actually, I should say that I was reading Envy and put it down to read The Most because I just felt like I wanted to read a book from start to finish on a Saturday. And I did. And then Sunday, I picked Envy back up. So.
Nice. Well, I had a really great reading experience with a book that our mystery man gave me. It's a vampire novel called The Gathering by C.J. Tudor. She's the author of The Chalk Man, which I haven't read, but I remember seeing it. This is such a fun vampire story. When I say it's fun, it's also a hardcore vampire story. It's not nice dating vampires like some of the vampire romances I've read recently. The main character is a woman named Barbara Atkins, who is a detective of forensic vampire anthropology. So in this world, vampires have become a protected class. So Tudor does so much with the vampires and humans that reflects our current political climate. It's really well done. I enjoyed that aspect of it so much, down to the point where some people have what's called a Helsing tattoo. Van Helsing is the doctor in Dracula who, you know, helps Jonathan Harker and his band of friends fight Dracula. So people who are wanting to exterminate all the vampires, who believe in a genocide for vampires, basically have a Helsing tattoo. They're considered a symbol of hate, kind of like the swastika. So this woman, Barbara, is sent to this small town in the middle of winter because there has been a suspected vampire killing of a teenage boy that's very similar to one that happened 20 years before. And a lot of the locals want to just go out and slaughter the local vampire colony, a colony of vampires who moved back after having been gone for 20 years. And this is another interesting thing, too, like this whole world that she builds very subtly. So initially, there were the Native Americans here, and then there were vampires, and then the white Europeans came. So the vampires, I think they lived in harmony, maybe, with the Native Americans, or they lived so far away that it was not an issue. But then when the white people came and started settling, problems started. So this is the world. Vampires are a protected class. A lot of people want to get rid of them. They don't like them. They have all these stereotypes against them. And here's Barbara trying to investigate this murder, and more people die. And I enjoyed it so much. She happens to be a lesbian. She's single at this time. She's kind of like that classic noir detective who is the loner type, who really regrets losing this love, who has moved on and knows she lost her because of her own inability to be intimate, because of trust issues. So I don't think this is going to be a series. I haven't heard any nods about that, but I think it'd be a really fun series because I think she could do a lot of interesting things with different areas of the country. Alaska in the winter, you know, that has its own vibe.
Well, you know, we could call her up, Chris, and make some suggestions. So when you say it's a serious one, that means like there's blood and gore and...
Yeah, there's blood and mean people doing bad things.
Okay.
Yeah. Really enjoyed it very much. Again, that's The Gathering by C.J. Tudor. It is out now. It came out earlier this year.
Sounds really good and perfect for spooky season.
Oh my gosh. And I read it like... I read this one in like two sittings, I think.
Yeah. I read a book that I wasn't expecting to read, Demon Copperhead by Barbara Kingsolver.
Yeah, totally. When you told me you were reading that, I was like, what? Where did that come from?
You know, I wanted an audiobook. I have been experiencing some insomnia, And you know, when I was talking about that O Reader magazine that I got up in Traverse City, there was an article in there about audiobooks and is it reading, isn't it reading, that sort of silliness. But the woman, and I didn't bring the magazine, so I'm sorry, I can't remember who the author of the article is, but she talked about how much audiobooks have been helping her menopausal insomnia. And I'm like, oh, me too, girlfriend. Like, I put it on in the middle of the night. I love that there's a timer so you can have it stop. So it was the middle of the night. I didn't have a current audiobook, and I got on my Libro app and was like, oh, that's right, I have a copy of Demon Copperhead to listen to. And I started it, and I was in right away into the story. I mean, the first sentence, I'm just going to read for you guys. I mean, I know a lot of listeners have read this book. It won the Pulitzer Prize in 2023. It won the Women's Prize in 2023. So here's the very, well, I'll read the first paragraph. First, I got myself born. A decent crowd was on hand to watch, and they've always given me that much. The worst of the job was up to me, my mother being, let's just say, out of it. And it takes off from there. And I saw an interview with Barbara Kingsolver about how she came to write it. One of the reasons I was nervous to read this is because it's a retelling of David Copperfield by Charles Dickens, which I haven't read. And I think when people say stuff like that, to me, I still harbor some of that. The classics make me get a little sweaty and nervous. And so I thought, oh, if I haven't read David Copperfield, A, and B, you know, I won't be able to take this novel in. It'll be too highbrow for me. Well, in this interview, she talks about she wanted to write about the orphans of the opioid epidemic. Where she is in Appalachia is the epicenter of where these companies who sell opioids targeted, because they knew that that area could be
profit-making for them?
Well, it was definitely profit-making for them, but that these particular people that they chose to target were susceptible to it. And so she was visiting Broadstairs in the UK, Dickens' home, and she said she'd been thinking about how to write about this for 2 years. And she was in his study at his desk, and she said it literally came to her as if he was talking to her, saying, you have to write it from the child's point of view. He has to tell the tale. And she sat down at the desk in Dickens' study and wrote the first chapter of the novel.
So amazing.
Isn't it?
Yes.
How it partly is David Copperfield-esque and Dickens-esque, I guess, which you could speak to, you're reading him right now. Short chapters. At the end, there's a sentence or two that makes you want to turn to the next chapter. And I would say, heck yeah, that's what this novel is. So I started it on audio. The narrator is Charlie Thurston. So good. Within a day, I was searching for a copy of the book, which was not at our local library anywhere, which surprised me because it's been around for a while.
Yeah, that's strange.
Yeah, I will tell you. In Biblio Adventures, where I did find a copy of the novel. So then I started reading it hybridly, reading it and listening, reading and listening, sometimes doing both. And it is about Damon, who lives in the Tennessee Valley and is being raised by a single mother who really didn't stand a chance and becomes addicted, and his going in and out of foster care and eventually landing pretty well. But that turn south. It's an amazing, amazing tale, and was also really hard to read and made me really sad. I think Barbara Kingsolver did a really good job of looking at the issue from different avenues and also taking the reader through the time period where people started to figure it out. Like, oh, this is corporate America causing a problem here, and things changing within the course of the novel. I think had she not done that, it would have just made the reader feel completely hopeless. And it has a great ending, I will say. I will not spoil it, but it did have a very good ending. But I have to tell you, once I started, I was like, I can't do anything else.
That's cool. That's good to hear.
Yeah. You know, I'm always searching for that kind of novel, right? So really enjoyed it. I have no idea how people who've read Charles Dickens and David Copperfield feel about people equating these two novels, I don't know. But it was definitely told as a tale from the main protagonist's point of view, and I enjoyed that aspect of it a lot.
Nice. I'm so happy you enjoyed it.
Yeah.
It's tempting me more. Well, the other book I read was a biography called Out at the Plate, The Dot Wilkinson Story, and this is by Lynn Ames. It is a biography of Dot, who was an award-winning, Hall of Faming catcher of women's softball and also of bowling.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, after she kind of retired from softball, she then became a bowler. You know, I'd never heard of her. I saw this advertised somewhere and I thought, oh, I want to read that. Catcher. I was a catcher, you know, when I played softball. And I enjoyed learning so much about how popular women's softball was in the 30s, 40s, 50s. Softball's a big thing in Chicago still. There's slow pitch and fast pitch, and Dot played fast pitch. And you get the sense of what the culture was like. You know, it was all kind of these small teams that got together to form leagues to play against each other. And they would sometimes build their own stadiums once they got popular enough, instead of sharing a stadium with another team or something. And that's just so fascinating to me. Some of it is people who just like sports, and other people saw a business opportunity, because some of these games were attended by, like, especially like the championships, like 10, 20, 30,000 people were attending women's softball games in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And it started kind of dying out a bit in the late 50s and 60s when TV sports, aka men's sports, started to be televised a lot more. So I think with a lot of things, women got kind of swept away. But the team that she was on, and she's from Arizona, Phoenix, Arizona, was very popular. They built their own stadium, which is fantastic. They actually did a lot of the physical work themselves. I have some notes. I took a lot of sticky notes and I wrote some notes. At one point, I wrote, she sounds like an asshole.
Do you mean like full of herself?
Not so much full of herself, but, you know, it was maybe a different time period too. Like, she did some unsportsmanlike things, I think. Like, she shook up a Coke and sprayed it on a ref, which I don't think was really cool. She threw water in another ref's face. I think that's kind of jerky behavior.
I mean, sometimes I think people who are real, I'm not making excuses for Dot, but sometimes people who are really competitive just don't know where to draw the lines.
Yeah, possibly, right? And I mean, and she was really hardcore, and also the captain of the team. Then she was also the manager of the team, because the man who started the team, World War II comes along, and he joined up, and he was in the Navy, and so gone for a bit, and then, you know, came back. And his story is interesting as well. I'd be curious to know more about why he got involved in this. But he kind of took her under his wing and got her working with him in real estate. And so Dot's last partner, she's a lesbian, they did a lot of flipping of houses before that was a thing. They learned how to do it. They used to call this plumber to come help them. He was kind of a handyman. And he finally said, let me just show you how to do this. Like, you're capable to do this stuff. So he trained them on everything. And so they would buy these properties and flip them or rent them out. And for decades and decades, people would say, oh, I lived in one of your houses. Like, she was really well known in the area. She lived to be over 100 years old and just passed away in recent years. So it's one of those biographies where you feel like you learn a little bit about the time period, certainly a little bit about that culture of softball and women's sports. And then you learn about this person in some ways, not a lot of her emotional depth, but kind of who she was on the outside.
Would that be the same time period as like A League of Her Own?
Yes. And, okay. And some people speculated that she was the character that Gina Davis played, the catcher, but she was absolutely not.
Okay.
And a lot of women who actually played in these leagues didn't really appreciate how the movie didn't want any smacking of lesbianism, which is something that is brought up in the book a little bit too, with like this one manager who was trying out players who only wanted pretty girls on the team. He didn't want masculine looking women, which is a notorious problem in women's sports, the homophobia that runs rampant there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So definitely that era. And, you know, they would jump in cars and drive all night, you know, or days on end to get from Arizona to Chicago, say, for the championship games. And one of the funny things, I thought this was odd, another note I made was there are a lot of extra inning games. A lot of extra inning games described in here. And extra inning games are usually not that common. So it made me wonder if some of those were setups just to entertain the fans and keep fans in the bleachers longer, since this, you know, sports is money-making, right? So,
I mean, I think there's a lot of that in national sports, mm-hmm. personally, but that's another whole podcast.
Yes.
But that's interesting. Yeah, yeah. I mean, a lot of it is about making money.
Yeah, for sure. And so Lynn Ames, who wrote this biography, befriended Dot, and Dot wasn't much of a reader at all. I guess her last partner even said, like, for years, you know, for decades, I was trying to get her to read a book and she never did. But when she found out Lynn was a writer, she writes a lot of novels, she's like, well, I want to read one. And so she gave Dot one of the books and she read it, like, boom, that weekend. So that was kind of a nice little aside, that somebody who wasn't much of a reader got into it because they met somebody who happened to write novels.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Nice.
And, you know, I should say too, it was Sapphic September is one of those hashtags going around on social media to read books about lesbians or buy them. So I think both The Gathering and Out at the Plate kind of qualify for that.
Good for you.
Yeah.
Nice.
So, yeah, again, so this last one I was just talking about, the biography, is Out at the Plate, the Dot Wilkinson story by Lynn Ames. And this is out this year from Chicago Review Press.
Well, I read two short stories and I did something that I was really proud of. I went to my bookshelf at my house and I took down a couple of the literary journals that I am known for buying when I go to bookstores, particularly when Chris and I go on biblio adventures. One of these, and I'm embarrassed to say I can't remember which one, was purchased at McNally Jackson. The first time we went to the original McNally Jackson, I think we might have been with Kate. You walk in and to the left in the main entrance, there's just an endless supply of literary journals, which is so exciting to me because you can't find them everywhere, especially a good selection. So I think that first time we went there, I spent my first hour just in that area in front of one shelf. Anyway, I read two short stories. One was from Plowshares, the fiction issue edited by Lauren Groff, and this came out in summer of 2015. Which is why, you know, I put these things on my shelf and never get them down. So I really wanted to do that. And this short story is by Rebecca Mackay, and it's called The Miracle Years of Little Fork. And I thought what I would do for both of these short stories is read the first sentence, because it's interesting. They both have to do with animals, both of these stories, the first sentences. In the fourth week of drought, at the third and final performance of the Roundabout Traveling Circus, the elephant keeled over dead. That's the first sentence of this short story.
Oh.
So this story is not going to work for everybody.
Yeah, I don't know if I could keep reading that one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what it is about is this small town that's suffering from a severe drought, and the circus came to town and the animals did suffer and the elephant passed away. And then because it's such a severe drought and elephants are so big, they have to figure out what to do with the elephant. But the story goes on from there, and also the circus folks end up staying in town longer, and actually the person who cared for the elephant ends up becoming someone who stays in the town, and the story really takes off from there, and it was very well written. I mean, Rebecca Mackay is a great writer. It's in this Plowshares, but it also came out in her collection Music for Wartime, which came out in 2015. And that's one thing I really like about these literary journals, is you not only can get introduced to authors you may not know, but also see what they have forthcoming. Because in the back of both of the journals, for both of these authors, it tells you that these short stories are going to be published in collections. The other one was in the literary journal N+1, and it's by the author Jenny Zhang, and it's called Why Were They Throwing Bricks? Hmm. And the first sentence is, and it's in quotes, I lost hearing in this ear when a horse jumped over a fence and collided against the side of my face, my grandmother told me when she arrived at JFK. I was 9 and hadn't seen her in 4 years. Mm. This story is about this Chinese woman. The short story starts with her being born in China and being by her grandmother's side for 2 years. And then her parents decide that they're going to move to America. And then grandma comes to visit them four different times throughout the course of this short story. And this short story is in the collection Sour Heart, which was Jenny Zhang's debut collection that came out in 2017. Whew, both stories really good. And I thought it was interesting that they both had animals in the very first sentence. Mm-hmm. So I'm really enjoying my short story project. And it was fun to do something different this time. The New Yorker has short stories in it every week. And I get these things and I think, oh, I should subscribe. And then I think, oh, it'd be so much pressure to have these. Like yeah. The people who subscribe to the New Yorker, mad props to you. I feel like it'd be serious pressure.
People who subscribe to the New Yorker and actually read it.
Right.
I know a yes. lot of people who subscribe and they're like, they just stack up.
Yeah.
But the covers are really cool.
Yes, they are. And I mean, the writing's really interesting and the cartoons are fantastic. And I just think, I mean, this is a silly thing to say, but I feel like my reading life would suffer if I got the New Yorker, you know, because I do feel like some people just want to read like that. And that's yeah. great, too.
Absolutely. You know? I mean, it has what's going on Broadway and everything. Right. So it's really a great magazine
yeah.
in that regard. Yeah.
I think about like when I retire, maybe that'd yeah. be one of my gifts.
My mother-in-law used to have a subscription, so that would always be fun. When we'd go visit, I'd get to flip through a lot of them.
I think that's actually the best relationship, visiting someone who has a subscription.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Less pressure. Well, Chris, did you go on any biblio adventures?
No, I haven't really. I have had some couch biblio adventures. Laura and I have continued to watch some Harry Potter movies. We have two more to go, so we're thinking maybe next Saturday, we might have a marathon and watch those last two movies. But otherwise, I have not. I mean, we had our fantastic Envy discussion with some listeners last weekend. So I'm definitely considering that a biblio adventure.
Yes.
So much fun to talk with everybody and just reconnect. And there's some new faces this time. So
yeah, that was really fun. So I have a question, because people talk about the Harry Potter books. Like, if you just start reading Harry Potter now, you can read the entire series. Whereas my daughter was the age of Harry Potter. So she had to wait for each of the books to come out and then the movies and all of that. So are you enjoying the experience of just being able to marathon watch?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this isn't even marathon watching. Like, Laura and I have actually done the marathon watch where we watch them all. We did it one New Year's Eve. We started December 31st in the morning. And we watched them, I don't know until what time we scheduled walking breaks between the movies, because we're going to like
not
adhere to the
move.
Couch.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we would watch a movie, go on a brief walk. So that's really intense, because you could really see some of the character arcs a little bit more clearly. But, you know, the movies are not all even. They all had different directors,
right.
different styles. I mean, one of the things is I know they all worked with J.K. Rowling about what do we need to include, what do we not, because these movies were being made before all the books
right.
were out. So it's just like yeah. they knew that there were some things that had to be in there, even if they were a tiny little thing in the book. So you know at least you're not missing anything crucial, although you're missing a lot,
mm-hmm.
especially in the books. The first two are pretty slim, but then by the third book, they're getting to be chunksters.
Like 1,000 pages.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's fun to be watching them again, at least a couple every weekend.
Fun. I don't think I've seen them all. I've definitely read all the books. I don't know that I saw the movies. I should watch
them. Yeah, you know what? Some of the things I remembered, I was like, oh, this is that one. And Laura's like, how do you remember that? Because we started watching these again because I had forgotten so much about the storylines and everything. One of the recent movies, I hardly remembered anything about it.
Yeah.
So we'll see these last two.
Interesting.
I don't know how much I'll remember.
I had two couch biblio adventures. I started Slow Horses Season 4, which is based on the fourth book in the series, Spook Street by Mick Herron. You know, some television shows are letting all the series out at once, and some do one at a time. This one's one at a time. And last week, I was all set. On Tuesday, I was like, oh, I'm going to treat myself. I'm going to sit down. And they're released on Wednesdays. So I was really sad about that. So now I know. Anyway, it's just so good. It does make me want to read the books, but I don't know if I'll step into that series. And then I finished Presumed Innocent, which I had started before I left for Michigan at the beginning of summer. And if folks don't remember, I watched the Harrison Ford movie that came out. These are based on the novel of the same title by Scott Turow. And then I started this 8-part series starring Jake Gyllenhaal that's out on Apple TV. It's very dark and much more gory than I remember the book being. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's just, I read the book a long time ago. But then they also changed the ending.
Oh, no.
Yes.
And how do you feel about that?
I have mixed feelings about it. I mean, I talked to the gentleman caller about it. I think he watched the Harrison Ford movie when I rewatched it, but he had seen it before. He's read the book. He did not watch the television series. But, you know, I said people know the ending, right? So in a certain way, because there's been a movie and a book and blah, 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 maybe they just wanted to do something and really shock people. It shocked me because the novel has a very 11th hour plot twist. And so the Harrison Ford movie stuck to the novel. And then this television series is sticking to the novel till the very end and then has a 12th hour twist.
Interesting. Do you think it was a good creative decision? Or did it somehow lessen the overall story for you?
It didn't lessen the story. I was like, why are you trying to shock me again?
Okay.
I guess. I think it did make it more disturbing, which I felt like the whole series was more disturbing. And I think they tried to do a lot more twists and turns because it was more current day than the novel was. Mm. And some of it worked for me and some of it didn't. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to say I loved it. And I also will definitely say I tuned into the last two episodes just because I wanted to see them. It wasn't like, oh, I can't wait. Whereas okay. Slow Horse is like, I'm sitting in front of my TV the day before the actual episode comes out. And then I'm totally disappointed.
Yeah, I felt that way about Ted Lasso.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And then I went down to New Canaan, Connecticut, to go to an art thing, but walked around the town and ended up going to their library. Oh. Beautiful, Chris. Oh my gosh, we have to go. So a lot of New England libraries, what I love about them is they take the old original library and add a modern part or at least another addition because the small New England libraries weren't big enough to support the current towns, right? This one, they actually took the old library down that had been built. It wasn't the original, and they built a brand new library that opened in 2023. It was a 10-year planning process and it's 42,000 square feet.
Wow.
And it's mid-century modern, which is very appealing to me, with lots of natural light and some LEED certified, so very good for the environment sort of thing. And then they moved the remains of the 1913 original little tiny library off to the side. And I asked the librarian, what's going to go on there? Because it looked like it had an exhibit of some kind, but the doors were all locked. Mm. And they said it is going to be used as exhibit space, but they're having a hard time figuring out how to staff it. Because if they open the doors and it's open all day, someone has to sit over there, right?
Yeah.
Which is, to me, part of the reason to have it attached to the main library, you know, which they made the decision not to. The librarian said that there was a lot of conversation about that, but it would have cost another $2 million or something to do that. And it was a $38.5 million renovation. But the thing I'll tell you, I was there at like 3 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon. Our library in Guilford had closed at 1:00. And I know that because I was there at 12:55 looking for a copy of Demon Copperhead. There was none. And they were making that announcement. The library will close in 5 minutes. It was 3 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon. That library was packed with people. They have so many incredible meeting rooms and space for just to be working and sitting and reading. There's a cafe, just a beautiful property. Outside, there's a lot of seating also that people were working at.
Nice.
Yeah, really gorgeous. And well used, obviously, and well loved. And I said that to the librarian, I can't believe how many meeting rooms there are and how they're all being used. And they were like, yeah, when our old library had 2 meeting rooms. And when I saw the plans for all these, I thought it was ridiculous. And now, you know, eating my words.
Yeah, very cool.
With people of all ages, too. There were a lot of young people with their computers working. And
so that's where you found
Copperhead. There were several copies of Demon Copperhead. And I went up and said to the librarian, can I use my Guilford library card? And they said, absolutely, and got me in the system. And I walked out with it and I was thrilled.
Nice.
Yeah. So New Canaan Library should be on our radar for maybe working at some point, doing like a work day.
That'd be fun. How long of a drive was it down there?
It was just under an hour.
Oh, not bad.
Yeah, not bad at all. Have you any upcoming jaunts on the calendar?
Well, I do have a few things. This week is the Wyndham Campbell Festival. We had on our last episode, we interviewed the director of the festival,
Mike Kelleher.
And so today, we're recording this on Wednesday, September 18th.
Yeah.
And Lydia Davis is going to be giving the annual Wyndham Campbell lecture, Why I Write. And as we've talked about, this lecture is part of a book that will be published by Yale University Press next year. So I'm really looking forward to that. I'm not going to be going in person. I'm going to watch the streaming of it. And then it will also be on their YouTube channel. So we'll put a link in the show notes to that for anybody who would like to see that. And Lydia Davis, she also caught my eye because she's the translator of the version of Swan's Way by Marcel Proust that some of us are going to be reading in February and March next year. Robin G has started a reading group, and there's a hashtag that she created called Proust Pilot Project. So look for that, or look for Robin G on Instagram. I'm super interested in this. And is it George Orwell? He wrote a book, Why I Write. And then I was wondering, is that where they got the title from?
Oh, interesting. You know? Yeah, because a book comes out every year from Yale University Press.
Yeah. So whoever does this annual lecture, it's part of that series. So that's something to track down.
I'm excited because there's a new romance bookstore opening up in Connecticut, the first ever. And the grand opening is on Saturday in Chester, Connecticut. So we're going to go.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that. That was a surprise. I hadn't heard about it until I think Publishers Weekly or Shelf Awareness, one of those lovely, informative book industry. I was going to call them magazines, but they're more like e-newsletters that we get, had it in there. So super exciting about that.
Yeah, it's called Montgomery and Taggart, which is based on, I guess, the Jude Devereaux novels. Back in the day, she had a series with those. I don't know if they were dueling families. I'm not sure. We'll ask the owners because obviously it was meaningful enough to them to name their store after that.
Yeah, and one of the owners is a librarian or a former librarian. She worked as a public librarian for 10 years, and this is her next endeavor. So,
yeah, I can't wait to meet them. And then we also have on the calendar a visit to the Eric Carle Museum of Picture Book Art up in Massachusetts.
Yeah, really happy we have that on the calendar finally.
Yes, cannot wait to see that and to go to the store.
Yes.
I love Eric Carle stuff.
Yeah, and we're doing it hopefully so we'll get to see some peak leaf action.
Yes.
Peeping of the leaves is a big here in New England. And just driving over to Book Hooker's headquarters today, I was really surprised. It seems like some trees just started overnight.
Yes.
They're turning. So, 'tis the season.
Yes, fall is here.
Yeah.
How about upcoming reads?
Well, we have a buddy read coming up. We are going to be reading Murder in the Smithsonian by Margaret Truman. Emily, John, Valeri, our mystery man, and I will be reading this because I found three copies at one of our local used bookstores. They were $1 a piece, so I had to buy all three. And I kind of figured you guys would be willing to dive in because it's another hopefully fun mystery from a couple decades ago.
Yeah, and we'll be talking to John about it on an upcoming episode in October. I cannot wait because you two, I mean, I remember when we did the, it wasn't Murder on the Orient Express, which is the book we read. I can't remember.
Oh my gosh. We did the one that the movie was coming out on.
It's on the Nile.
Yeah. Death on the Nile.
Yes.
Yes.
We read that one, the Agatha Christie, and talked about it. That was years ago now, I think. Maybe during the pandemic. I can't remember.
Maybe, yeah.
So I'm excited to, because I always feel like Chris and our mystery man are more mystery readers than me, so I learn so much when I read a book with y'all.
Well, this should be fun, everybody. So we're talking with John at some point in October.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can get a copy and you want to read along with us, please do.
Yes. Speaking of our mystery man, he posted a picture of his little free library that he has in his front yard, which is lovely. And in it, facing front, was this book by Ellen Hildebrand, Swan Song. And this novel is titled correctly because this is also her swan song from writing this particular series, especially, which is her Nantucket series. This is the fourth and final book in the series. The other books are A Summer Affair, The Castaways, and The Perfect Couple, which is just came out as a Netflix special, I think an 8-part series starring Nicole Kidman. But Ellen Hildebrand is also stepping down from writing. I think she's maybe going to be doing some writing with one of her children, but just kind of stepping off this hamster wheel that she's been on for years of putting out novels a lot and doing a lot of book touring. And she wants to spend more time with her family. All of that being said, that was very long-winded. John posted this picture of his little free library with this book facing out. And I said, oh, I really want to read that. And he said, I have a dinner date with Chris. Would you like me to pull it out of the library and save it for you? And I said, yes, please. And then Chris arrived with this book, of course, because it's our mystery man. It's not just a regular copy. It's a beautiful Nantucket special edition with fun, beautiful end papers showing highlights of Nantucket, lighthouses and different stores that are there and beachy themed things. So thank you, Chris, and our mystery man for getting this into my hands. And I have to say, when I first moved to Connecticut, I read some Ellen Hildebrand because I wanted to fall in love again. And I wanted to read some books with some romance in them. And after reading Demon Copperhead, which was a lovely novel, but very heavy, I'm looking forward to stepping back into Ellen Hildebrand, Nantucket land. And it seems perfect for the end of summer, too.
Yeah. Well, the only other thing, I want to just give a shout out to another reading event that's happening in 2025. Last episode, I mentioned a couple things already. The Classics Club is going to be doing a sync read of all of Jane Austen's novels to celebrate her 250th birthday next year. So she published 6 novels, and they will be reading them on different months. And this whole idea of a sync read, S-Y-N-C, I really like this, you know, as opposed to a buddy read or a read-along, because what they're saying a sync read is people are going to be reading it around the same time, but there's not going to be a schedule, there's not going to be necessarily a check-in, anything like that. If you have a blog, you could write posts about it. I like that idea.
Yeah, it's just kind of support from the sidelines, I feel like. Like giving people a little bit of form to think about how to do it, but not putting too much structure around
it. Right, yeah, exactly. And, you know, letting people know there's other people reading it around this time if you do want to chat with people. So they're going to be reading the novels in chronological order of publication. So first up will be Sense and Sensibility.
And you've read all of them, correct?
I have, yeah. Yes. Now that I corrected the Mansfield Park situation a couple of years ago. So I'm going back and forth on whether or not I'll participate, especially now that I'm reading Rebecca Romney's book about her adventures with Jane Austen.
But the thing I remember when we talked to Rebecca is that she also calls out some of the authors that really inspired Jane Austen. And I wonder if that might be more compelling to you to put in your TBR. We'll see.
Well, I've read a couple of them. So yes, and that's what the bulk of this book is about, the women that Jane Austen read.
Right.
So the first chapter, like her introduction is really cool, and the first chapter is on Jane Austen. And what I like about that book is it is combining her sleuthing with her personal story with Jane Austen's story in Jane Austen's books.
Yeah.
It's really a great read for Jane Austenites and anybody who likes women writers, I think.
So we'll see if your Trello can fit in all of the Jane Austen books next year.
Well, I already have a Trello for Jane Austen, a card. I have a Trello card. I'm still getting the terminology right. So I have a reading board, and then within each board you have cards. And I did make a Jane Austen card.
Okay.
So I can easily swipe them over into currently reading or up next.
Right on.
We'll see.
Yes.
I'm really liking this thing. I'm feeling much more relaxed about my reading, and I feel like I'm kind of getting more reading done without it feeling like pressure.
Maybe we need to have you do like a Trello class.
A Trello class, yeah.
If anyone's interested, let us know. And in the Out Now category, reminder, these are books that we've talked about on prior episodes, but they weren't published yet. So we just want to remind you that now they are available. Death at the Sign of the Rook, a Jackson Brody book by Kate Atkinson, So Thirsty by Rachel Harrison, and If Anything Happens to Me by Lou Anne Rice. That's her new YA novel.
Out now.
In the meantime, you can listen to our lovely conversation with the author James Benn, talking with us about Phantom Patrol, which is the 19th novel in the Billy Boyle World War II mystery series.
Enjoy, and we wish you all
happy reading.
We are thrilled to welcome James R. Benn. We first met James back in 2018 at an author panel we moderated at Mohegan Sun in partnership with Bank Square Books that featured James along with Fiona Davis and Melody Winawer. James is the author of the Billy Boyle World War II mystery series, as well as several standalone novels, including Souvenir, On Desperate Ground, Shard, and Free Gift. We're hoping this will come up in our conversation, but just in case it doesn't, we also want to shout out James's 35 plus year career working in library and information technology. The first Billy Boyle novel was published back in 2006. The 19th book in the series, The Phantom Patrol, will be published in September by Soho Press. Welcome, James.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Jim, back in the acknowledgments, when you get to the very end of the book, you talk about Soho Press and the publisher, Laura Pruska, who sadly is no longer with us, but you talk about that she gave you, an unknown author, this chance with the first two books in the series.
Yes.
We met you first in the 13th book in the series in 2018. Now we're talking to you about the 19th book in the series. So could you briefly just take us back to those early years and, you know, how you came to write Billy Boyle?
Actually, it goes pretty far back. So I have to take it to 1972, when I went to the movies on the opening day of The Godfather, because I've always been crazy about gangster films. So I had to be there. I went by myself. I sat front middle row, and I was blown away by the whole movie. But the opening scene really piqued my interest. And if you recall, that's the garden party, the wedding party for Sonny's marriage. And Michael Corleone is there in his Marine Corps officer's uniform with a Navy Cross, one of the highest medals for bravery. He's the only guy in a uniform. Everybody else is just in their pinstripe mobster suits. And that takes place in August 1945. Any other party with a decorated Marine Corps major in America, he would have been the center of attention. Nobody pays him the slightest mind. If you analyze that scene, people are walking by, brushing against him. He's just explaining to Kay who all these people are. And it struck me that that was an interesting dynamic, that he was the white sheep in a family of black sheep. And the Corleones cared about their family. They cared about the family business. They cared about their heritage of Sicilians. And then the America and the government, maybe a little less so. And that just always struck me as fascinating. I thought, what if it had been Sonny who had to go to war? What would that have been like? And I did absolutely nothing about that for 30 years, but it just stayed plugged into my brain. And then when I decided I was going to finally try to see if I could write, I pulled that notion out and turned it into Boston Irish and the police instead of Sicilian American and the mafia. But it's really the same dynamic. The Boyles are a very tight-knit family. They come from the Boston Irish heritage, where the Irish flooded into the police department to take jobs after the First World War and took it over as their private fiefdom. And the Boyle family is Irish Republican leaning. They want a united Ireland. That's where their sympathies lie. And the notion of putting Billy Boyle into this mix and having him be this kind of naive character who has to navigate this new world he's thrown into, and having all those prejudices from his family, just really piqued my interest. And I wrote two books before anybody was interested in it. And that was Laura at Soho Press. She was a very intense woman. She would champion you, but she expected a lot. One thing I didn't quite understand was the role of the editor and what they had to do. So we went through the first book and she sent me paper back then with red marks. Literally every page had red marks. And I never thought about, well, gee, maybe for the second book, I should go through and apply what I've learned and fix it up a little bit before I said, I just sent it in. I got a call from her. It was like, Jim, you're now a professional writer. You have to do better than this. And I haven't been yelled at since like junior high school like that. But she really taught me a lesson. Like, you can't take this stuff for granted. You've got to put out your best work every time.
That's a great story.
Yeah. Gosh, thank you for sharing that. Good advice for everyone. Yeah.
Yes, on many things. Yeah. So give us your elevator pitch for this 19th book in the series, The Phantom Patrol. What's up with Billy and his friends now?
All right. Well, they're looking into art thefts in the part of France that's been liberated. Early on in the series, I had wanted to do something about the Monuments Men. But then the book came out, the movie came out, and I thought, well, it's everywhere, so I don't want to ride the coattails. So I put it away, and then in this book, we're exploring what happened to all the artwork that was collected, saved from those trains that they were sending them to Germany in, found stashed all over France, and there were collection points. So there was a lot of artwork just stashed everywhere, and he's investigating a theft run by a gang of German deserters and criminals in Paris. And that was really my way into the story, to explore that and have them collide with the opening days of the Battle of the Bulge in a search for witnesses at the front. So I got to do a little bit of art theft work in there, and also just give readers a view of what it was like for the GIs at the front, who didn't really know what was happening. They didn't know that this was some big planned battle. They just knew that all hell was breaking loose in front of them. So he's got to navigate that. And he does it in some interesting company.
That's a good way to say it.
Yes. Yeah, that's definitely one of the questions we had for you, Jim, is about some of the people in real life whose names we know and some we don't. How do you plan to use those types of famous people within a novel?
You know, I can't say that it's planning. I look around for anything and everything about the subject matter that I'm writing. I had read David Niven's two biographies, in one of which he talked more about the war, his war experiences, than the other. And he was just such a fascinating character. And then I found out that J.D. Salinger was actually a member of the Counterintelligence Corps and was attached to the 4th Infantry Division, which fought all through France. And he was in charge of interrogating prisoners and rear area security. So he was really like a cop for this division and an investigator. So I thought, well, he'd be a good person to have on hand. And I discovered that Salinger, being a writer, was just very obedient as a character. You know, he understood what I was trying to do. David Niven just wanted to be in the book on every page, and he's such a fascinating character, and he left so many stories in his two memoirs that I had a hard time ushering off the stage at the appropriate moment. He was a whole lot of fun to write.
We should interject for listeners who don't know. He was in Hollywood, right?
Yes.
And ended up going to the war, and throughout the book, people wave to him knowingly, knowing that he's this famous actor, and he kind of plays it off and sometimes uses it in his favor.
Yes. He was the only British actor who left Hollywood and went immediately to sign up. The British government had asked all the actors to stay there and sort of portray Great Britain in film. And Niven had none of that. He went right over and went back into the army. He had been an officer and ended up doing intelligence work. So the time and place fits for where he would have been. And that's my criteria. I don't like to make these situations up out of whole cloth. But if I find that somebody was actually in this time and in this place and would have fit into the investigation, then that's fair game. And it's just a lot of fun, too, to bring them to light. In next year's book, number 20, I just sent in to Soho, and I was researching radio interception during the war and how the British would spoof radio communications to the German Luftwaffe. And I stumbled over the name Conan Doyle. Jean Conan Doyle, the daughter of Sir Arthur, was a British intelligence officer in the Royal Air Force, fairly high up. And she was in charge of one of these bases where mostly women, Wrens, a lot of them from German-speaking refugees, would stay on the airwaves and spoof the directions for the night fighters going against their bombers and just do all sorts of interception work. And I thought, how can she not be in this book? She has to be there. So we'll meet her next year.
Oh, that's so cool. Looking forward to that. Well, and even with your ongoing characters, there was one character who makes an appearance, a quick cameo, it felt like, Jackie Astor. Now, he's a real life person.
Yes.
But did he have a larger role in a prior book?
No.
Okay.
He was part of Niven's intelligence crew. And I just thought it would be fun to give him a mention because he's fabulously wealthy, the Astors. I mean, but he was on the front lines doing his bit.
Oh, very cool.
So how do you do your research? I mean, you've been doing this now for 20, we now know, mm-hmm. 20 novels. Are there times where maybe 15 novels ago you read something and you said, ooh, there's a book in this. I'm going to put this off to the side.
Yeah, definitely. What I look for is something that is not all that well known that I can delve into and illuminate to a greater degree than it has been. But it's somewhat constrained by the timeline because I would say, not because it's a mistake, but I'm very chronological. So these stories happen one after the other. And I was always in awe of Philip Kerr and his Bernie Gunther character. You know, Bernie Gunther was a German policeman who was brought into the army and had his own decisions to make. But Kerr wrote without regard to chronological order. So one book might be set in the 30s, one might be set in the 50s. And I thought, oh, geez, that was really smart. But I've got to look for something that fits into the chronological order. So when I do find something, that's, oh, great, that's really going to work. And in this case, the advent of the Battle of the Bulge was coming up, and I knew I had to address that somehow. And shoehorning in the investigation for stolen art with the run into that battle was a way to do that. But yeah, I'm always on the lookout for something that I can fit in and weave a mystery around.
So how do you keep track of everything that's come in the prior novels? Do you have any type of spreadsheet with characters that you need to consult, or are you just listeners?
No.
Pointing to his head.
You know what? Somebody, I did another podcast and that was the exact same question. And I guess, you know, showrunners have a Bible, right? But no. I do, in my mind, keep track of the secondary characters. I think a lot about series fatigue, and I don't want people to get the sense that this is the same story being told. So within the constraints of the chronology, I try to modulate the stories in terms of setting and the subsidiary characters, because there's a basic two or three characters in addition to Billy, but then there's a larger cast beyond them, and I can pull in people. I might decide it. His love, Diana, hasn't had a major role yet. So in this book, let's bring her forward. And then in the next book, it'll be somebody else. So I do try to pay attention to that and not have the same tone in one book after the other.
So Speaking of characters, can we talk about someone that was a real life person who's very important to this novel, Rose Villand?
Oh, yeah.
Is that how you say her name?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, let's talk about her and the role she played.
Well, she was incredibly brave. So Rose Villand was a rather lowly museum worker in Paris, and she was kept on by the Germans, and she never let on that she could speak German. But she was in charge of cataloging all the artwork that was being brought in, and this was the museum where Goring would come to Paris and do his shopping. And he actually would pay something so that he would have some kind of phony provenance. But she kept secret records of all the artwork that came through that museum. Right after the liberation, she was briefly attacked as a collaborator, and I mean physically attacked. But some people came to her aid and explained what she had been doing. And she later was made an officer in the French army, was given all sorts of well-deserved medals. But she really kept track of the stolen art that came in, where it went to, because they sent a lot of this stuff on trains from Paris to Germany. So she was central in keeping track of where the looted art went to. And some of this stuff was art taken from French museums or homes. Most of it was taken from Jewish families. And there's a scene in this book where she takes Billy to a warehouse where not just artwork, but personal possessions, furniture, was taken from Jewish families in Paris. And that was a scene that was kind of haunting to me. It was, in one sense, even worse than seeing dead bodies. It was the remnants of people's lives just stored away for use in Germany. But yeah, she was a remarkable woman. And she was played by Cate Blanchett in the movie with George Clooney. But in reality, she was a kind of person that would not attract attention, which helped her do her job, because she was just this mousy little museum worker who kept taking notes and would take down everything that the Germans said to each other when they didn't know she was able to. So, remarkable woman.
Amazing. Yeah. I am curious, now that you've written this novel and done this research, mm-hmm. what you thought of the Hollywood portrayal in the movie.
Well, it was Hollywood. I mean, it was a little overdone. It was a fun cast to watch, but I think they really could have told a true story and done a much more interesting job of it. It was just sort of a kind of a romp, you know, with the Downton Abbey guy getting shot kind of oddly in that church. So I can't say it was great, but it did bring the story forward to people. So mm-hmm. that's right. something. But the yeah. book itself, and the Monuments Men in Italy, this is a book as well, was very well done.
Good. Well, with all the research that you do, Jim, is there anything that still surprises you when you're researching the current story that you're working on? Or do you feel like you know so much about World War II in general at this point?
When I started, I thought I knew a lot. And now I realize I don't. I think the thing that surprised me over the last few books, The Proud Sorrows last year and the one that's coming next year, was how creatively the British and the Americans used Jewish refugees and their language skills. So when I was talking about Jean Conan Doyle, she oversaw a section of Women's Reserve Air Force, WAFs rather, in England, who were doing all this interception of German radio signals. That couldn't have been done by somebody who just knew German. It had to be somebody who could speak it like a native. And the Americans using refugees who had come out of Germany as teenagers in the 30s to do interrogations. And I'd never heard of any of that before, so that did surprise me. But I think the overall thing that I've kind of been surprised at, and this is not a one specific element, but the degree to which it was really a war that we were fighting with an ally that was not our ally, the Soviet Union. They knew what they wanted. And it's very similar to what's happening today with Putin. They wanted control of as much of Europe as they could get. And they really played Churchill and Roosevelt like fools. So we won the war. But in reality, when you look at the map, 1945, at the end of the war, half of Europe was still under the control of a totalitarian power. So I guess I'm kind of surprised at how much that was never brought out in the history books, that, yeah, they were our allies, but didn't help the people who had to live behind the Soviet bloc very much.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. Thank you for bringing that up. Another thing I appreciate about the series is that you bring in so many things that seem new and fresh, even like the point with the Battle of the Bulge being named later on right. by, I think, a journalist who mm-hmm. happens to look at a map and sees the movement or the plan because it had other names earlier on. But then you also, you know, talking about like the people, the unsuspecting people who are doing this crucial work mm-hmm. or work that becomes crucial later on is, I think, fantastic, because I think so much about war, or so many war novels and movies, it's about the combat quite mm-hmm. often. Mm-hmm. And that's just such a small part of war
right.
and military in general. I don't want to give any spoilers, but there's one scene fairly early on in the book where someone has died and the person's lieutenant is the one responsible for writing a letter mm-hmm. home mm-hmm. to the next of kin. So I think it's Billy who says to the person, "Writing is your responsibility, but his death wasn't, and you shouldn't discount it as an accident. It's the war. If we weren't mm-hmm. fighting the Nazis, blank would mm-hmm. have been living his life back home. Everybody who dies, whether it's in a car crash or at the front, is a casualty of this slaughter." I just appreciate that, because when you think about World War II and the totality of the war, that mm-hmm. it was a world war, like yeah. everyone was touched by it, certainly the people who enlisted. But I just appreciate that about your novels. They don't glamorize war.
Yeah, that's one thing that especially I don't want to do. And if I could just take a second, I'm going to read a very brief quote from J.D. Salinger from one of his short stories that I put at the front of the book just to bring home that very point. So this is from a short story, The Stranger, they wrote in 1945. It's a story in which a GI goes to visit the girlfriend of his best friend who was killed at the front. Don't let any civilian leave you when the story's over with any comfortable lies. Shoot down all the lies. Don't let Vincent's girl think that Vincent asked for a cigarette before he died. Don't let her think he grinned gamely or said a few choice last words. These things didn't happen. So I think that's part of Billy's mission, is to bring out what kind of truth can be revealed about what it was really like, whether you were, you know, in a motor pool behind the front or a cook bringing up hot meals to the front. Everybody was in this and was in danger.
I think that's a mic drop right there.
Yes.
Yeah. We were going to ask you about J.D. Salinger in that short story. You just brought it home. Thank you.
You know, we probably all read J.D. Salinger in college and whenever, and that I had memories of his works. And it wasn't until I read a lot about him and read his war record and then went back and reread some of his stuff. Everything he wrote was about the war. I mean, literally everything. He landed at D-Day with six chapters of
Catcher in the Rye.
Catcher in the Rye in his backpack and worked on it the whole time. So he was present at the liberation of a concentration camp. You go back and you read a story like A Perfect Day for a Banana Fish, and you can understand his agony. So that was very revealing.
And then he lived a long life. He lived to be 91 years old.
Yeah.
I think that he was really traumatized by his experience there.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And there's something so real about this series that you've written that I think is beautiful for helping people to understand that.
Thank you. Well, on a lighter note, I'll tell you that I'm starting the 21st book now, and it's totally different. It takes place in Cuba, and our special guest is going to be Ian Fleming of British Naval Intelligence. So I'm having a lot of fun thinking James Bond thoughts and letting Billy enjoy some rum and sunshine.
That's awesome. Because you started Billy Boyle. The first book is 1942, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then so in this current book, Phantom, it's 1944.
Yeah.
So I was wondering, you know, the war, there's like a year left. So I was wondering what your future plans are.
You know, that's a very good question because, you know, time is running out. And I decided all I can really do is think about the next story and write the best story I can. And we'll see where it goes. I mean, you know, I do cram these things in. If you pay attention, Billy seems to go from one adventure to the other pretty quickly. But as long as the ideas come and we bring them to the end of the war, who knows? He might have some other places to go. There's enough ideas to keep me rolling for a few more years.
Well, as I was reading Phantom Patrol, I was like, well, let's see. He's meeting all these famous authors. He's met a Hollywood star. Maybe Billy's heading to L.A. when this is all over.
Now we're talking.
So we'll see. Hollywood might be in his future.
Oh, gosh. Well, James, thank you so much for taking the time to come on to talk with us today.
Oh, it was fun.
Thanks for listening to The Book Cougars with Chris Wallach and Emily Fine. We'll be back again with another episode in 2 weeks. Until then, come chat with us on social media, Goodreads, or email us at bookcougars@gmail.com. If you'd like to help support our podcast, please tell others about us, leave a review wherever you listen, and consider becoming a patron. Even $1 a month is a big help. Learn more about that on our website, bookcougars.com, where you'll find the show notes for this and all of our past episodes.
Thanks, everybody.
This episode was edited by Pat Keough Sound Design.